Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Unconventional Soldier, a military podcast brought to you by two British Army veterans in association with ISAR.com.
Welcome everyone, and thanks for downloading another episode of the podcast. This is our Christmas film special, and it's been hosted by our resident cultural critic, Simon Vincent, all the way from New Zealand. It's great to have you on the pod, Simon. So what have you got planned for us today?
Kia ora koutou. Thanks very much, Kevin and Colin, for having me along. Well, I thought, you know, it is towards the end of the year, and I thought we could try something a little bit different and talk about some of the favourite films that we watched, and maybe reflect a little on why they resonated with us in the troop and the battery over our times. But first, I think before we press play on the movies, we need to set the scene a little bit. The three of us all joined the OP troop when it was part of the British Army of the Rhine. This was in the days before TripAdvisor and the like. Everything outside the gates in Germany was, well, it was a bit foreign to us. When we went out in Dortmund, it was to drink in the squaddy bars with other squaddies, or do adobe, or stock up on kit to make our life in the field more bearable. We were not exactly cultural explorers, making the most of Nordrhein-Westfalen's museums, cathedrals and scenic hotspots. Let's face it, we struggled to cope with the culture shock of mayo and Fritz in the local Schnellimbiss.
Still got the German though, Simon. Good to see it.
Yeah, I've not lost it. but you know, looking back on the time, I do feel I missed out on a lot of the opportunities that now, as a pretty well-cultured gentleman, I would have seized upon. How do you two look back on our days in Germany?
I think you've got to look at through what was available. As you said earlier, there was no Netflix, there was nothing. So, and we're pretty, I think it's just immaturity, isn't it, in some respects? You know, the biggest cultural thing we did was go to the Monazay Dam and sing the Dam Busters tune and run along it after a few beers.
I think also we were isolated away from the community a little bit, and you did feel that as well because of the way that the camps were structured. Your social network was always going to be inside the camps. It was always difficult, and obviously we enjoyed going back to the UK for leave, and then we'd all meet up in the UK. But yeah, we were very an isolated group.
And you couldn't get in a lot of the bars as well, if you remember. That's why you used that term squaddy bar.
A lot of the pubs just
wouldn't let you in.
No. Yeah. In the early days, in early to mid-80s, we weren't really welcomed in a lot of places, even the more cultural places that we didn't try to get into.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking back as well on how I remember there used to be a German language course for people as they and to service over there, but that was limited as well. It wasn't as if they really pushed for us to integrate any better. But, you know, like you say, we couldn't get in half of the bars. And then when we went back on leave into the UK, we couldn't get in half of them either. So, you know, maybe there was a reason behind it all.
Yeah. I blame the Germans, Simon. It's dead easy to blame the Germans.
Yeah. But you know, when we were, you know, spending our time in BAOR, if we were not on operations, exercises or training, a large proportion of our time was spent in barracks, in our rooms, living with the people we worked with. The NAFI or the PRI shops had provided us with kettles, stereo systems, TV and a video player. The British Forces Broadcasting Service was only offering very limited programming, so videos rented from the NAFI offered us a form of escape from the routine of our in-camp life. Ah, the video. It was all VHS back then, no access to streaming services. The limited movies we did have access to got watched over and over again, and generally with the same mates making the same comments over and over again. The movies themselves, I think, became a big part of our routine. And as might be expected of a bunch of squaddies, films with a military angle or at least weapons or explosions or the like were a big part of our playlist.
Yeah, I think we can touch on that later on, Simon. But I think because any soldier wants to go in operations. And if you can't go in operations for real, I think you go in operations through films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's it. We sort of, you know, it was the sort of busman's holidays to a degree where we're watching what, you know, what the movie world portrays as life that we're supposedly leading to some extent. But, well, let's discuss some of those films. And I've loosely grouped them as the Golden Oldies, Hollywood Epics, Close to Home, Vietnam, and now for something completely different. So let's start with the Golden Oldies. These are predominantly covering World War II. The actors all had very much the BBC accent. Often the films were essentially reenactments of an actual event that took place during the war, with a few changes to keep post-war morale high. I'm talking films like The Battle of Britain, Dam Busters, In Which We Serve. Do they touch a chord with you guys?
I think the 70s, we're all 70s kids, aren't we? And you think back on it now, well, we grew up in the 70s, weren't born in the 70s. But I think back in then, all the veterans from the Second World War would have been about our age now. And yeah. Britain back in the 70s was obsessed with 1939 to 1945 for some reason.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think when I first joined, I went to France with D-Day veterans, and they were only 60 odd years old, and they took us through obviously where they landed and everything else, and you forget that actually, you know, they were old men, a little bit older than we are, in fact a lot older than me, obviously. but their memories and their, and then I watch things like The Longest Day, because then you'd have exactly the same, or you'd watch World at War. Yeah. World at War was all that real footage. Yeah, I found that. We forget how big an event World War II was. We're never going to understand that because we didn't live through it.
I also think it's the last time that Britain during the 70s probably perceived it as something well. Mm. Because the 1970s Britain, economically, wasn't doing too well, and we were the sick man of Europe. And I think it was a sort of a harking back to a golden age when things were a bit clearer and Britain was doing okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I always remember is a lot of these films were shown, as I was growing up, were shown on a Sunday afternoon. So you'd have had your big lunch. You're in front of the TV watching one of these films, and they must have sort of struck a sort of chord with the parents and the older generation watching them, you know, harking back to the day. But for us, there was probably just, you know, bit of action and adventure at the time, mm-hmm. and we were seeing them. But it's funny because I, you know, look back at a few of them, and you know, we've mentioned the Dam Busters already, and how, you know, that was, I guess the story of a film like Dam Busters was quite simple in a way. There's a problem or perceived problem, you know, there's this heavy industry. It's got to be stopped, but how do you carry out the task? So the film follows that line of coming up, experimentation, practice, giving it a go, and then to a final conclusion. And I think it was also part of that. I wouldn't say jingoistic, but it was putting a powerful message that, you know, we as a nation achieved something. And I think as well, one of the other things that struck me was, you know, a lot of the actors had possibly served as well.
Yeah, Richard Tubb, you know, yeah.
He dropped in indeed, didn't he, Richard?
Yeah, he was seven para. Not RHA, but actually one of the seven battalions. Yeah.
You're gonna say proper parachute battalion.
Oh, that, for our listeners again.
Contentious.
That's yeah. Colin.
Yeah.
Me.
There you go. But it's funny as well that, you know, again, of the time we were watching the movies, you know, they existed in that context of other things that were available to us on TV. So now I look back and I think, you know, all of the actors had very pronounced, what do we call it, RP accents, BBC accents. And anyone who, and a lot of the characters were the officers, that was where most of the action centered around. And anyone who was another rank was probably someone with a BBC accent trying to do a Cockney accent or a Comedy Northerner. And so it was a bit Dick Van Dyke if it wasn't, you know, to be in a movie in those days, you probably had to be a, you know, quite a high class.
He's a radar and all the rest.
Yeah,
of
it, yeah. So he had that.
But Dan Bus is unusual, and it featured a civilian as well, and like Barnes Wallace, didn't it? Because he was pivotal. Yeah. But interestingly, at the end of the film, I don't know if he says in the film, but I know reading books about it, he reckoned that he hadn't invented the bouncing bomb because the toll on the air crews. I think of the 19 aircraft, 8 of them were shot down.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's part of that framework of sort of. It's partly about morale, but it was partly about justification as well. You know, all of these, you know, the movies we've talked about here, while, you know, I don't think anyone would say World War II, we shouldn't have been involved in any shape or form, but it was always, there was always that sense of, we want to show the public why we did these things. And some of them might, you know, at the times, even in the '70s, were, you know, there was a movement around, CND was growing and things like that. So there was, you know, potentially some backlash to military at the time, but, watching those films again at the time were probably a good way of showing, look,
we had think, Simon, sorry, go on.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had a difficult task and we achieved it as a nation.
When you touched on morals there, I think as well with the Dam Busters, it was the only film probably that could have been made about Bomber Command because the raid on the dams was pretty clean. All right, I don't say this glibly, but only a few thousand civilians were killed. You know, and it was against a specific target. Where you compare that to the area bombing and the firestorm in Hamburg, where tens of thousands of people were killed. And even in the 70s and just after the war, Bomber Command never got a medal for their campaign because the whole moral side of area bombing, even just after the war, was up for debate.
Well, just another one. I was doing a wee bit of research for this, and one that struck me was, talking of aircraft, was the Battle of Britain. So that came out in 1969. And about one of the biggest expenses was getting aircraft replicas or originals to actually be involved in the flying scene. And they basically said, you know, just to make it look as realistic as they could, basically, you know, nearly bankrupt the whole movie. The cost of the aircraft was more than the cost of everything else involved in the whole putting together of the production. And the guy who that all fell down to, the producer, was sort of at the end of it, was left, well, I've got all these planes now. What am I going to do? But I guess he managed to sell them off to some enthusiasts afterwards.
They've got a lot of Messerschmitts from Spain. Seemingly, I think the Spanish Air Force got a load of Messerschmitts for some reason.
Yeah.
What year was that again, the film?
69 it came out.
Well, it's still obviously Spain was still being run by
Franco.
Yeah, so he would have had a lot of German kit probably.
Absolutely.
You know, going back to the cultural side, one thing the Brits always do is they always like to take the mickey out themselves, you know, about the war. And you look at things like Dan's Army, Alolo. And just going back to the Dam Busters quickly, do you remember that Carling Black Label advert where you had the German goalkeeper on the one dam?
Yeah. I think that's one of, you know, the other things as well within all of these sort of films. There's always that little vignette of, you know, the a major character doing something a bit funny or a little mistake or, you know, or showing the home life and that side. So it was generally, you know, down the line, the movies were almost like a military operation. We've got to show this piece. We've got to do this. Then we'll do this, but we'll throw in a little bit of humanity at some point to catch everyone along. Yeah. All right, shall we move on to the next section?
Yeah.
So I've called these the Hollywood epics, and, you know, just like our patrols, these ones generally featured an all-star cast. These were the movies like Dirty Dozen, Great Escape, Where Eagles Dare, a personal favourite of mine, A Bridge Too Far. These films, I guess we're starting also to see a lot more plot and character-driven elements in these films. So, you know, it wasn't, here's the story and we'll tell it, almost like a government-made film. These were actually where they said, hang on, we've got some really top, you know, actors here. Let's really put them out there to the public in full-colour cinemascope. You're talking people like Charles Bronson, Telly Savalas, Lee Marvin, some big names of the time, Clint Eastwood, you know, so real big, powerful names, and they all came together. A lot of these films were based around a sort of, you know, a ragtag group of soldiers brought together for a particular mission. Yeah, very much like the OP troop, I guess. I really, really have enjoyed watching some of those and just seeing how, it really took you on a journey, I guess. A lot of them did focus on getting that group together, training them up, and then will they succeed in the mission? Resonate with you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, going back to what you were talking about earlier, Simon, 1950s, black and white films about Britain's part in the war. 60s onwards, you start to see that shift where the tales told about the war are from an American perspective. You know, A Bridge Too Far is definitely the American side of that operation, a lot of it as well, I think.
Yeah.
Well, The Great Escape, I mean, in the real Great Escape, there was no Americans involved.
Yeah. I guess that's it. You know, it's where we are actually seeing, you know, to get this film across the line, we need a bit of star power and that's what they did. But, again, I always, you know, like watching things like The Dirty Dozen. I mean, there must have been a lot of truth behind that story. I don't know too much really about the truth of it, but I do know. So one of the things about The Dirty Dozen, they essentially took soldiers who were in prison facing court martial, in some cases potentially up for a firing squad, and gave them a suicide mission. You know, you've got to be involved. If you survive this mission successfully, we'll give you immunity and things like that. So that was the plot. But I also know there was a lot of, what was his name? Lucky Luciani, the American gangster who was flown into Sicily. So you know, there was a lot of things where people were starting saying, well, actually, these people who are maybe not the best soldiers in terms of drill or, you know, how they're perceived as part of a unit may have some qualities that are useful. And I think a lot of these films try to portray the outsider element as well.
Do you know what I reckon as well? Tarantino is in Glorious Bastards, or Bastards, or however you pronounce it, owes a lot to the Dirty Dozen in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That, the magpie there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it. You know, people like him have obviously quite often showcased some of their, you know, where they got their ideas from. But you know, mentioning the more modern version, and I must admit, I have not watched Saving Private Ryan, for instance, or
you haven't, Bunker, seriously? Or,
no. It was just one of those things. Wherever I was at the time, it you know, I didn't see. So, but how do you think that sort of old generation, if you like, of Hollywood epics stands up against some of the more modern version with the star power of these films?
I think Saving Private Ryan was a game changer in that opening scene. The downside is you get the feeling that the Americans were the only troops on D-Day, and the only British troops that get a mention is when a segment of the film they're slagging off Montgomery's effort and the British effort. But that opening scene in Saving Private Ryan, I mean, you can see it influenced everything after that came in its wake. Do you not think, Kev?
Yeah, I think probably my favourite, more than Saving Private Ryan, is Band of Brothers. Even though it's not a film, the serious Band of Brothers actually, it's raised the bar massively for sort of war films. Because the realism, I think they've brought more realism into it. They've brought the horror as well, which I think maybe some of the classics avoided a lot of that. They didn't have the amputees on the beaches. They didn't have, you know, that sort of level of violence. It was there, but not the same, because Hollywood, it's a family film, isn't it? The Great Escape is played every Christmas. It's a family film.
Yeah,
and that sort of stuff, and that's what they pushed on. Plus, I think it was the era as well, because the 60s and 70s, obviously America was in its Vietnam War, and they didn't want to show the horrors of war when they got people being drafted and sent off to fight.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, actually, exactly. You don't think about that, do you?
Yeah, they softened it maybe in that sort of way, because during that period, the 60s and 70s, there's really no Vietnam films about the Vietnam War.
True. Yeah.
I mean, the other one I just want to quickly bring up is, because during that period we're talking, there's not real many British films getting through all the Hollywood stuff, but Wild Geese got to be an absolute classic.
It's
got the fattest, oldest mercenaries in the world.
What's the classic line from his little lad? Oh, I'm so happy I could scream. I'll go on then. Yahoo!
You've got the famous medic. Come on, my lovelies.
Taking
on the Katanganese soldiers.
I think as well, it's you know, as Kev mentions, Band of Brothers. I think that was, you know, another important part is they're going down into the, you know, the real human side of the story a little bit more, you know, within those sort of productions, because the big ones, it was all about getting an audience in, enjoy the time, eat the popcorn and get out. And I guess as we've moved on, there's a little bit more about, let's get an audience to think a bit more. It's probably.
I also think you get a sense of scale from things like Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers. When you see that scene in Band of Brothers where they drop in, you know, and there's a very clever shot where it comes out the aircraft through the door they're going to jump, the side door they're jumping through, and pans back, and you can see all the aircraft flying over the channel, and you get a real sense of scale of what it must have been like.
Yeah, I think one of those that stands out to me as well, because of it's done very well in a few books I've read where, you know, they close in on an individual and they're saying, you know, this is the feelings, this is how this person's going through, you know, this momentous occasion. And then it pans back and says, and there's thousands and thousands of others, you know, in that moment in time as well.
And the other thing people forget is, I mean, the main difference between the Allied forces and the German forces, I mean, our forces, the Brits and Americans in the main, were citizens' armies. They weren't conscripted. Sorry, they were conscripted, but they were citizens' armies. So it wasn't like the Wehrmacht or the German forces, whereby it was a dictatorship. You had to go in. You know, if you didn't do your job, you're executed. So even though Allied forces were conscripted, there was an element of democracy about it. You had to look after them. You couldn't just sacrifice them needlessly like they did in World War One. I think that's another thing that comes out in Band of Brothers. You know, that those airborne guys were volunteers on top of a citizen's army.
I think there's also an element, you know, to build on from that, where because, you know, these were just regular people who were in an extreme situation, but you know, that's how we now are able to look at them. But I think we touched upon this when we were talking on about books, in that, you know, if someone was a prisoner of war, while all the glory goes to those who tried to escape and did that, but for so many people, it was a, wow, I'm safe, I'm alive. And this is probably better than, you know, it's better to sit here and sit out the war than anything else. And, you know, again, fair play to them for, you know, being in that situation anyway.
Absolutely, mate. So the next section we're going to move on to?
Yeah, now I've called these close to home because I think these are the sort of movies that start to cover some of the conflicts that ourselves or our contemporaries would have actually been involved in. And it's sort of fairly broad range, really, but I've included the movie Who Dares Wins, Tumble Down from the Falklands, and Three Kings from the Gulf War. I always remember, and I just as the sort of bit of background on Who Dares Wins, it was kind of loosely based on the Iranian embassy siege that the SAS took part in 81. But I remember reading the book. Now, the book's called Tiptoe Boys, and the writer, James Follett, was a journalist who lived around the corner from the Libyan embassy, and he sort of said, wow, there's got to be a story in all this. It was at the, you know, when the SAS were first becoming really in the public's attention because of this. And he decided to write. And as he was writing, he also let people know, you know, what he was up to. And someone said, okay, we'll do, someone bought the rights and we'll make a movie of it. But what actually happened, he was writing it chapter by chapter. And as he wrote a chapter, it was flown off on Concord, I think, to screenwriters in the States, and they were putting the production together at that time. So it was as he was writing his novel, it was also being turned at the same time into a screenplay, which is quite unusual for filmmaking in itself. But it was a film which I think anyone who watched it would have obviously got the connections to the Iranian embassy and things like that, which had probably just been on the news, you know, literally a year or a few months prior to that movie coming out.
You look back on it now and it's like bad TV movie now, I think. And certainly amongst the other films you're comparing it to there, it doesn't stand up very well at all.
And I think there's an element of that. I mean, Lewis Collins was the star, and he was, you know, he came from that sort of TV, you know, background in The Sweeney and The Professionals. And things like that. And so, yeah, it was probably making use of his status to make a movie. But yeah, absolutely. It's probably wrong to say it's comical to look back. It's like everything, things are of their time, I think, when you look back. But you know, it was interesting to see something so
but Lewis
recent.
Collins.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry. Lewis Collins, I don't know if you know, he served with Four Para.
Yeah, that's right.
And did P Company, and he was gonna go for either 2-1 or 2-3 SAS. But because he had a high-profile public image, he wasn't allowed to. And I was reading a couple of things online about Lewis Collins, and he's quite well-regarded. There's a couple of his DS in the Parachute Regiment at the time had wrote in saying he was a good soldier and pretty fit.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that, you know, of his time, he's probably one of those who, well, from everything I've seen of him, it, you know, an opportunity came up to be a star, and he jumped at that. But if things had gone other ways, he would, you know, he looks like he would have been, yep, I'm going in the military. That's the path for me. But, you know, red carpets, champagne and all that. Yeah.
Or stuck in a trench, crapping in plastic bags.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think also is of the time as well, because the '80s, especially the early '80s, late '70s, and Colin mentioned it earlier, it was quite a depressing time in the UK, high unemployment. We needed good news stories. So the Iran embassy was a good news story. And the film came at the right time. It was a bolster to the British psyche, perhaps, to make us all feel a little bit better about ourselves, because there wasn't a lot of good news at the time.
Yeah, well, I did read one review that basically said it was a Conservative Party political campaign as such. It was almost, you know, it was too good to be true for a sort of a government at the time.
Yeah,
to show that. Another one, and again of reflecting a similar time of when it was set, but came out in 1988, was Tumbledown, which was Colin Firth. I guess that was one of his first real, you know, came into the public's consciousness. And this was based around a guardsman in the Falklands who was injured and came home. And I guess it was controversial in that it was starting to show someone's feelings after a conflict and a feeling that it made a big thing of saying that, you know, we weren't looked after when we returned.
It's probably worth pointing out, though, Simon, the character it's based on, Lieutenant Robert Lawrence, he was shot in the head just during the reorganisation phase of the battle. And he lost something like a cup full of his brain.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And when he was taken off the mountain and he got to the regimental aid post, when they were doing the triage, they just left him to one side because they thought he's never going to make this.
Yeah.
And after a lull happened, one of the medics was walking past him and just happened to see him move. So it's an incredible story of survival as well.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, there's that element of what is there for those survivors or those people who come back afterwards and how they're treated. That, I guess that was a big, you know, second half or second act or whatever you call it in the film world that focused on. Yeah.
So looking at the ones you mentioned there as well, so I think the Vietnam ones all stand out. And for me, Platoon, not only has it got a load of great lines, I think a lot of the lessons in Platoon are still applicable today. And the main one being is sort of toxic leadership.
Mm.
And you see it in the sort of the two of the platoon sergeants, Barnes and Elias. And I think it's Barnes is the scarred veteran with no moral compass. And as a young soldier, that's the one you sort of gravitate towards because he's the hardest. But looking back on it now, you realise that he was quite toxic as a leader. And a malign influence on his platoon. And you tend, as an older, I think, you know, you start to gravitate to Elias, who was trying to do the right thing throughout some pretty harrowing moments in the film.
Yeah. And I guess in a way, you know, partly these sort of Vietnam movies, Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, Apocalypse Now, even Good Morning Vietnam. I guess it just was a time. So they sort of came out while we were serving in the military. So, you know, it's something we're going to be interested in. But it was, you know, predominantly Americans in Southeast Asia. But, you know, we don't ever want to forget the Australian classic, The Odd Angry Shot. That must have been on heavy rotation, you know, in our barracks. So, you know, I watched it so many times. And you're right, that's the look at the different types of leadership. But, you know, things like The Odd Angry Shot also showed some of those, you know, patrolling skills, and that actually, you know, it really got into the what must it feel like to be there, probably more than some of the older films, which were more, you know, big screen epics in the view. These really got down. And I think it's a jungle as well. You know, jungles are by their nature dense and enclosing. And I think it brought that side to it as well. You know, you really feel a part of it.
It's a film, a firm favourite of Kev's, that one, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, but I tell you, I need to reach back a little bit because one of my favourite films is Porkchop Hill, which is Korea. Mm. And again, it showed, it was the late 50s, I think it was done, so it wasn't done too soon after the Korean truce. And it showed that it wasn't like a normal Second World War film. It did show all the faults, the failures, the wider political piece as well. And I it's still one of my firm favourites. And it's also one of the first films where you had black soldiers fighting, right? Because in the Second World War, they weren't able to fight. It was only later there was like films about the American Air Force. But in the Korean War, it was a different piece. And also, it didn't give off an anti-war vibe. It was just about obviously fighting for a hill that they were going to give back anyway.
Yeah, and you saw later on, though, actually, that's a good point about the black troops, because by Vietnam was fought, they're all drafted, and it was predominantly uneducated black and white kids from the poorer parts of the states that got involved in that war.
Yeah, who couldn't beat the draft, who couldn't defer. But at the same time as the Vietnam films came out, obviously MASH was, although it was supposed to be focused on Vietnam, Korea, was a very anti-war, but it gave that view of the wars that were going on at the same time. Mm. And MASH is a classic.
I mean,
although not a film, I mean, they did make a film.
They made a film as well, yeah.
And then the series, but absolute classic film, MASH.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, you talk about the poor, less educated elements of the soldiers who, you know, fought in Vietnam and was showcased in the movies. And I think that's a really interesting point, because I guess for people who were drafted into Vietnam, you know, that's where a lot of the focus came on, the story of these people. And even, you know, the officers and other ranks were to some degree in the same boat, in that the officers had come in quickly. It wasn't a kind of old stages who's a military veteran who's been around for 15 years who is now leading on. It was quite often it was someone who didn't know what they were doing either, who's, you know, rocked up on the same boat as the guys. So,
and you saw that in Platoon, didn't you, where the platoon commander was weak and was dominated by Barnes, wasn't he?
I think as well, another thing that I guess always intrigued me slightly, especially with these sort of films as well, was we quite often got to see the before as well. So before they went to, you know, the big centerpieces of battles. So we'd see in a few of the films, you'd see the training sequence, you know, them actually going through boot camp, as it were, and what it was like in barracks back in the States before they were sent out. And, you know, it's always full of the sort of cliched screaming drill sergeant, the whole
Full Metal Jacket,
you know, break them down so we can build them up again. All of that.
There's
kind
some
of process.
Great one-liners.
Yeah.
I mean, but Full Metal Jacket, again, is the Saturday evening. Glass of something to drink.
But he was an actual Gunry started.
It wasn't his part. Apparently, it wasn't his part. He just got the part in the end, and he made it his part, and then that's it. Because I think he was supposed to instruct the actor to play a Gunry Sergeant.
Well, fact from the film here, you know, in Full Metal Jacket, where the door gunner's shooting up the civilians in the fields, he was going to be the Gunry Sergeant.
Right.
And he got booted off because the act Lee, R. Lee Ermey, got the part of Gunry Sergeant Hartman.
Yeah. But it's also, just too good.
But don't forget as well, the other thing that you tend to forget is, because we are getting on a bit now, but Vietnam, when we were on the trip, had only finished 13 years beforehand. And I remember going down on the LERP Medics course at the LERP school in Weingarten.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of American SF medics there teaching who had served in Vietnam. So
yeah.
Sticking needles into us and putting in IVs and getting taught the use of tourniquets. And these guys had done it in the jungles of Vietnam.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I guess that's part of it, possibly for us is, you know, you do see a connection. Those people were still around. Likewise, you know, people who joined up in the '70s, they'd have been joining up at a time when they were still, you know, Second World War or Korean veterans around them as well. So yeah, it did sort of bring a lot of things home. And I guess, you know, talking of these movies, there's, you know, Oliver Stone himself, you know, so again, who directed Platoon, you know, he served in Vietnam. Yeah. And so there's that whole thing of, I guess, these creative types wanting to tell their story as well. You know, this is what it was like for me, you know, and yeah, it's...
I think as well, the other film we haven't mentioned is Born on the 4th of July, which is based on the real story of Ron Kovich, I think, who was an American Marine who was shot in the back and became a paraplegic. And there's a brilliant scene in that film where he's in a bar playing pool and he's pissed out his head and he starts complaining about the Vietnam War. And a guy who's playing at the next table comes across and calls him a pussy and said, "I was at Iwo Jima with the Marines." And I think that highlights that sort of generational change where that Marine from Iwo Jima was involved in a war that was black and white, and that it was, without being too bland, it was good against evil with a definite aim. Whereas Kovich is in a wheelchair, paralysed against a war that's, let's just say, morally dubious maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of that whole... you know, you could class it as gung-ho or don't go. You know, there was that look of a lot of the Vietnam films. Do we want to portray all this action and heroism, or do we want to look at, you know, the reasons why? And I guess a lot of films, you know, later on fed off that, Killing Fields and things like that, which were really looking at, you know, a deeper elements between some of these conflicts as well.
So it makes the World War II films, even the later ones, it's safer ground, less controversial.
Yeah,
you concentrate the story and the character without the background politics that overhung it.
Yeah.
I think as well, it was glamorous to the uninitiated. War is glamorous.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and to young men. And these days, young women, they look at it and they see these films and there's a glamour attached to them. And as you know, when you go in operations and it hits you for real, it's not very glamorous at all.
Yeah.
Not stagging on.
I guess there's that, I think it's a, you know, a human element, you know, that thing of I can imagine people watching these sort of films and saying, I wonder how I would cope, what would I be like in that situation? So I think that appeals to a lot of people. They want to see how they would deal with something, or they imagine how they would. But
and I think we were like that, didn't we? Do you remember when any tour to Northern Ireland came up in the '80s? Because back in the '80s, before Op Granby, Northern Ireland was your only chance to get on operations, and people were knocking down the doors to get over to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, or I was going to say, now that might not be quite accurate timeline, but or building walls to.
Absolutely, build a good wall.
Yeah.
Kind of private end jokes in a podcast.
Yeah. But, there we go. No, but it. I've always found it really interesting as well, and I guess from the Vietnam, whether it's just a a general chronological fact of life, but it's still giving in terms of movies. So you're now getting movies about old veterans from Vietnam, possibly more than you ever did from any other time. So, you know, there's a Clint Eastwood, Gran Torino, where he's, you know, an ex-vet who's having his car stolen by the hoodlums. You know, he's in his 50s or so, 50s, 60s or so.
And it's an anti-hero as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite racist, isn't he?
Yeah. But it's kind of showing that, yeah, the psyche or the injured warrior or, you know, the trauma is now part of a theme of movies that are being made, you know, back in America of American life today, but they are reflecting on, you know, what caused our people to be the way they are.
And I think the other reason Vietnam movies are so successful is Vietnam had the best soundtrack going.
Yeah, definitely.
That music from the 60s. I mean, yeah. You know, you look at all they had, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Hendrix. We went to the Gulf War 91 and got Vanilla Rice. There is no justice.
But I guess then if you're going to talk about, you know, the music of it, then Good Morning Vietnam was a, you know, an interesting classic. Sort of sidebar, if you like. While there was conflict in that, that wasn't the be-all and end-all of the story. It was the story of a DJ serving in Vietnam and how he tried to raise morale and go against the, you know, the starchiness of that backroom, unit he was involved in. Yeah, great film.
The Americans are probably in Vietnam. You get job as a DJ or in Full Metal Jacket as a journalist on the front line.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the things that always, strikes me is how different, you know, that portrayal of conflict is because of the American influence. I remember, in the Gulf, one of the, once we had gone through the breach and we were sort of head down, one of the next things I remember seeing was fleets and fleets of American vehicles carrying Coca-Cola vending machines, you know, because it's part of, you know, it just showed how different they are to us in a way. But yeah. There we go. But I guess for me, really, you know, all these movies we watched and watching together, it's a real part of, I guess, maintaining and growing the bond that we had in troop life. You know, when we weren't out in the field, we were hanging out together watching these films. And, you know, there's a lot of these movies that some of, you know, the toughest times, you know, when you know the RSM is going to be checking the areas the next day, that you need to have a bit of fun. And that was alleviated with, you know, some lines from some of our favourite movies. So there's a few films that I've loosely put under and now for something completely different, which really, you know, aside from the military type movies, we also watched a lot. Classics like the Blues Brothers, even Die Hard, Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Italian Job. Some great movies, but one of the things that is a real memory for me, and I think it was Ferris Bueller's Day Off, it would have to be, was there was some general or something coming to visit camp in Dortmund, and it was a huge, all camp areas was going on, and the whole place was being swept to within an inch of its life. But up in a little room in the block, there was sergeants and warrant officers and troops of the OP troop, curtains drawn so no one could see, watching a movie. You know, we're not going to be out there doing that. We're going to hide. And I always remember Sergeant Major at the time, sort of, you know, every so often go, shh, 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 they're coming, turn it down a bit. And then we could turn it back up and watch it. You know, the movies really gave us a little sense of escape, I think.
No, I agree with that, mate. And I think those comedies as well, the quotability, used to get them on Exercise and all the rest of it. But there are things like Billy Connolly. That time his stand-up videos were doing the rounds as well. And I always remember, you know, a few beers at night on a Friday watching him.
Yeah, yeah.
A few beers.
Well, a couple of beers for you, Kev. Lots of beers for the rest of us.
But it is. It was. I mean, going back to when we went through selection, Colin, we Gaz had a comedy video that we watched all the time, and Toodly Rudely Daughter, and you know, watched that constantly, and it was just you know, a real icebreaker element. You know, it allowed us to lighten up the mood wherever we were.
And I remember when you'd be out on exercise, hanging out your backside, and maybe meet up at an RV, and instead of doing the password or the pass number, it'd be Toodly Woodly.
I can't think that, you know, that can't be you know, discounted, the amount of, you know, the ability to raise morale or get you over a tough time was just that little bit of shared experience and a little bit of, you know, just something that gave you we're all into this together, and we're all, you know, we all singing from the same hymn sheet, really, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. I always remember, I'm a big fan of the Blues Brothers and watched it so many times. And again, that's a quotable film par excellence. And I always remember in Northern Ireland, actually, when in South Armagh. So just, I guess, my last tour anywhere, really. And was in a brick, and we came together, sort of, there was a bit of a chinwag going on, and you know, four of us all got together. We all leaned in, and you know, I was brick commander, and I sort of just looking around at all of these earnest faces wanting to know what's going on, and I just couldn't resist it, and I just went, orange whip, three orange whips, you know, a sort of Blues Brothers line, and it was, you know, probably some of the young lads are going, what the hell's he on about? But you know,
start to show your age there.
But it's just one of those things where, yeah, you know, there's got to be something that breaks the ice a wee bit.
Kev, you any Kev's always going on about things like Get Cut or Serpico.
Oh, yeah, because
come on, mate, we can't let you get off without saying something about those films, because I know you love them.
Yeah, well, I think the 70s brought out some of the real gritty films. I think I sort of looked at the American sort of film industry, and because again, Vietnam was on, so they couldn't really focus on war films as such unless they were of Second World War issue. So a lot of the old American detective cop films came out, you know, the gritty New York, some based on true stories like Serpico and Super Cops, and then obviously the fictional ones like Popeye Doyle in French Connection, which was absolute fantastic, and it still stands the test of time. If people,
and I would say, mate, you were the Popeye Doyle of the troops.
What? I wore a pistol on my ankle
and a trilby.
But they were just classic films, and I just thought, and Get Carter again.
Yeah,
at the time in the early 70s, Michael Caine, it was getting to be a big star, doing a gangster film in Newcastle.
Classic. I think you're right. I think the gritty element was a real factor. French Connection, obviously, you know, a brilliant movie, but I wonder if part of it for ourselves as well, it's not so much that, you know, it was something we were likely to experience. You know, we weren't in New York, we weren't in the police sort of thing, but it's that being up against it, mm-hmm. having to find your way through, you know, deal with difficult situations. I think that's part of what resonates with us, but also it's just really good movie making, isn't it? You know,
yeah, and Serpico and all that sort of stuff, and Papa Doyle and all that, they were always on the outside of the norms. They were always operating against the system as well as trying to do the right thing in a bad way.
That sounds familiar.
I think that's what appealed, wasn't it? That nonconformity.
Well, I remember one podcast, Simon, I used the term maverick to describe guys in the troop, and Kev said, no, we can't use the term maverick. That makes it sound like, I don't know what you said, Kev, but you know what I mean?
Yeah,
maverick comes across as a negative, I think. It's almost like, whereas unconventional,
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about people like Wingate, not comparing us to Wingate, but Wingate was not a maverick. He was enlightened, perhaps, is more. But for the majority of the army, they used the term mavericks as a negative about the way he was trying to operate.
But I think MD on the outside looking in would have used the term maverick for us.
Mm.
But a quick one as well, going back to how use of lines, are you going about that orange whip thing? I always remember on PT, it was a classic Carter line, because they're always trying to beat each other. And it was always that, if somebody came in behind you, it'd be the, you're a big man, but you're out of shape. For me, it's a full-time job.
Yeah. But I guess as well, you know, the cliche of a lot of, you know, the cop movies, like you say, it's the slight outsider who always gets, you know, called in and says, I'll have your badge and I'll have your gun and you're out of here, sort of thing. And, you know, I guess with us, they gave us a badge eventually, but people are still trying to figure out how it should look as well. So,
nobody wanted to give us a gun, mate.
Yeah. Well,
So we haven't got any desert island dits this time, Simon. What you got planned for the end of the pod?
Well, I thought, I guess because we talked about books and movies now, and I suppose one thing missing is music, and I think you know, there's been some classic movies, music made with a slight military element to them. You know, we've talked about Vietnam, so there is the classic Vietnam, a great bit of Jamaican reggae. There's 19. Kev's favourite, In the Army Now by Status Quo. But
you've
ruined
the street cred, Simon.
Yeah.
Who's Status Quo?
But are there any songs that stand out for you guys?
I'm going to go a little bit left of field. Back in the 80s, when we were listening to all this stuff and watching all these films, it was all about the Happy Mondays, the sort of Manchester scene, New Order. And I think I was a bit of a secret hippie, and I always liked a bit of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, that sort of 60s stuff. So I'm going to pick Ohio. And it does have a tie-in to the what we've talked about, because it's about the National Guard shooting dead four students protesting against the Vietnam War at Kent State University. And I think as well, and a bit of the irony is that these kids protesting that got shot were probably unlikely ever to go to Vietnam because they could evade the draft. And I just read Chrissy Hynde's autobiography and didn't realise she was at Kent State when this happened, and one of the blokes that got shot was the boyfriend of one of her mates. So I do like a bit of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Neil Young, I've got to admit.
Cracking.
Kev, what are you picking?
Well, I went more the classic war films. So I went back to the Battle of Britain, and it was the dogfight scene, and the way that there was no sound apart from the orchestra, and it was... It was called The Battle in the Air by Sir William Walton. But I just thought the way they captured the music and the action, it just gelled so well. And for me, whenever you see it or you hear that music now, you can picture the dogfight. Mm. And some of them really young kids that did 20 hours training the Spitfire, and all of a sudden then they were thrown into the air to go and fight the Germans, who were far more experienced at air warfare.
Nice. Well, I guess I've stuck with some of my favourites, but I always think this is a bit of a movement away from the normal. So I'm a big Joy Division New Order fan, and New Order brought out some brilliant records. But one that struck me is an album track called Love Vigilantes, and Bernie, when he was writing, he said he wanted to do a bit of a redneck tune. He'd been listening to a bit of country, and he thought he'd try to do something. So he wrote this song, and it's essentially the story of a guy who's returning from a war that had to be won, and he's returning to his family. And basically, he gets home, and as his wife opens the door, she falls down on the floor, because the telegram in her hand says that I was a very brave, brave man, but I was dead. And so it's this kind of, he just tells a little story of someone coming home, and he said he had no idea where the idea came from. He just ran it through, and so it's very un-New Order-like, but the premise of the song is really great. You know, someone saying, "For my country, I would die, and I will see it soon." You know, is a really moving element of what is kind of a jokey song, but a real great one. Yeah.
Coming from Manchester, though, mate, lots of back in the day there was like a war zone at times, so he's probably not far off of that experience.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the things I always find interesting when you look back at, you know, and music's a great one for it because, you know, there's all album covers or pictures of a band and places like Manchester, Liverpool, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, Glasgow, Birmingham. The amount of ruins and rubble and things like that, it was, you know, we were growing up when there was still a lot of
bomb sites.
Yeah.
Well, funny enough, I was talking to somebody the other day there about this, and I was saying that when you came back on leave from Germany in the 1980s, the contrast between the two countries was huge. You went from Germany, which is a well-ordered country, neat, tidy, you know, a really nice transport system, and you came back to the UK. And it just looked a dump. It was filthy. It was, the trains didn't run on time. And there was a huge contrast between the two countries.
Yeah. But they still didn't quite suss out how to stop squaddies jumping on trams without paying. But, you know, there you go.
But yeah. They did have the all-day drinking, mate, and that was another contrast. Yeah, that back was, to the UK. That, yeah, pubs were open 11 till 2, then shut till 5, and then open till 11.
Yeah.
You couldn't go down the laundry, then go in the pot for 12 hours in the UK at the time.
No, that was it. But, you know, those cultural differences were, you know, an interesting one because there was us. You tell us we can drink all day. We just go hammer and tongs. This is it. You know, we're meant to be pacing ourselves and trying things out. But no, it was.
Well, I went back to Dortmund in 2005, and we left there in what, 1993, I think it was. And I decided, I was there with a couple of guys from 12 Regiment, which the regiment I was into before I came to the troop. And we deliberately did a tour of all the bars that we struggled or couldn't get into.
Hmm.
And I got chatting to one of the barmen there, and he said it was a bit bizarre. He's saying that, yeah, they didn't let us in because we behaved badly a lot of the time. But looking back on it, they didn't realise how much we brought to the local economy.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, massive.
Yeah.
I mean, Dortmund, God knows how many gunner regiments were there.
Mm. It was 5, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Plus all the dependents. Must have been 5,000-6,000 Brits there, I think.
Yeah, that's a massive amount of money.
Yeah.
Employment.
Right, so thanks for coming to the pod, Simon. It's great to have you back on.
Thank you very much.
Cover next Christmas.
Thank you.
So, and also thanks again for listening, for your continued support and suggestions. And as usual, please keep them coming. And you can get it to us through our email and social media links, which are at the bottom of the show notes. You can find us on all the usual suspects, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And if you want to get in contact with Kev, you can send a pigeon or a Royal Mail letter. How much is a first-class stamp these days, Kev?
Yeah, I don't know. I just buy them. I just ask for first class stamps. I hand over my card and they give me stamps.
There we go, mate. So,
modern technology.
Tips for life.
Modern technology. It's modern, isn't it?
If you've downloaded from iTunes or like the podcast, please leave us a review or leave us a review where you get your podcasts. It's a great way of building up the audience. And thanks again to Nick Buell for his continued support and sponsorship to the series and offering technical support through his company, ISAR. And we'll see you next time on The Unconventional Soldier.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.